Welcome to another week of our 4.5 year verse-by-verse journey through all of God's inspired Word. We are right at the tail end of our fifth time through that Word. And soon we will begin the sixth time through. And I hope you will start inviting people to join you in that journey the next time we get started. But for right now, we want to open back to Revelation chapter 21. And we've already finished the millennium. We finished the Gog-Magog War. And now John wants to describe to us a special place that is going to be the center of our experience for eternity, the place where God is on planet Earth forever, a new Earth. And so let's begin in verse 1 again. I know we did a little bit this last time, but I want to go back over it and really stress this. John says, "Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and the sea was no more." Now, this is actually something from the book of Ezekiel, chapter 65, I think is the first place that this gets mentioned, right around verse 17. Let me get there myself and read it to you. The prophet said, "For," and this is actually God speaking to the prophet, "For behold, I create new heavens and a new earth, and the former things will not be remembered or come to mind." So all of the tragedy, all of the bad stuff that was part of the experience here on the current earth that we're on, the fallen earth, the fallen world, all of that is going to be gone once we're in the new heaven and in the new earth. And then in Isaiah chapter 66, verse 22, it also mentions it, and it has something that you hear me say from time to time. That's coming up in a little bit. But Isaiah 66, 22, it says that just as the new heavens and the new earth, which I will make, will endure before me, declares the Lord, so your offspring and your name will endure. So just a promise that once we get into this new heaven, new earth, it's forever. There will be no other glitches, no other hiccups like what we saw in Genesis chapter number 3. And then Peter is the one that I love, after he kind of describes how the current heaven and earth are going to pass away with great heat and great noise at the time of the coming of Jesus at the end of the day of the Lord. He says, we need to be better people based on believing that. We need to be doing what we can to move people toward that day. And then he kind of finishes the topic with this, 2 Peter 3:13. According to his promise, we are looking for new heavens and a new earth in which righteousness dwells. And you'll hear me use that phrase a lot in connection with what we're looking forward to. The place that God always wanted us to be. Because remember, in the book of Genesis, God created matter. He created the heavens and the earth as a place for those made in his image and likeness to dwell in happiness and pleasure and satisfaction and enjoyment and ingenuity and experimentation of all the good possibilities. That was what God always wanted. And then sin came into the world and it screwed it all up. But God already had a master plan to get past that sin, and that was Jesus. And it's taken all these thousands of years to bring that plan to its fruition. And once we reach the end of the millennium and everything gets back to the way it's supposed to be, we will be starting fresh in the new earth, just like Adam and Eve had in chapters 1 and 2 of the book of Genesis. All right, now what about the no-see? I already kind of speculated with that we're going to have some topographical changes, geographical changes in the new earth that may do away with the sea that these guys were so familiar with, which is the Mediterranean. But even taking that out of the picture, the next thing that we see kind of does away with the sea place. John says, I saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. And yes, I do believe this is literal. I would agree with some of my amillennial friends that there are metaphorical aspects to this that are tied in to the Old Testament symbolism of God being married to Israel and the New Testament symbolism of the church being married to Jesus, but I still believe it's a literal place as well. And that certainly was the belief system in the apostolic era and in the first couple of generations of the church, because it's written down there in their writings. I was just recently reading from Irenaeus, who was writing in the 2nd century of the Christian era, and he was talking about the literalness of New Jerusalem coming down to planet Earth. And he even reported a little rumor that some people thought that they were seeing something up in the sky, and they were getting excited that maybe this was the New Jerusalem getting ready to come down to planet Earth at any moment. And that's fine. You always get that overexcitement going on when people think about the future. And sometimes, they jump ahead of God. But here in Revelation 21, we see it happen. Verse 3, I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, behold the dwelling place or the tabernacle of God is with man. He will dwell with them, and they will be his people, and God himself will be their God. And as I was sharing with you last time, this is the language we've seen in quite a few of the millennial passages of the Old Testament, that the whole point is that eventually, once everything is taken care of, God will be able to get back to being on planet Earth in the regular presence of his created people and will interact with them on apparently a daily basis like he did in the book of Genesis chapters 1 and 2. And there will be this perfect relationship between us. Verse number 4, he will wipe away every tear from their eyes, and death shall be no more. Neither shall there be mourning, nor crying, nor pain any more. Now, it is intriguing to me that as I'm looking at my English Standard Version on my laptop here, that references back, they have a footnote that references back to chapter 7, verse 17, where those words are used. But the reality is, that actually comes from Isaiah 25, which we talked about when we were talking about the wedding feast of the Lamb. Because Isaiah 25, starting verse 6, says this, on this mountain, the Lord of hosts, he who is over the armies, will make for all peoples a rich feast, a feast of rich food, a feast of well-aged wine, of rich food full of marrow and aged wine, well refined. And I told you at the time, don't worry about the menu items on this. That was a way of Isaiah's time to say a really fancy feast, a really special dinner. And so that's what we were looking forward to at the second coming of Jesus and the wedding feast of the Lamb. But the more important, more significant thing comes next, the part that is actually being quoted in Revelation. He will swallow up on this mountain the covering that is cast over all peoples, the veil that is spread over all nations. He will swallow up death forever. And he who is God will wipe away tears from all faces, and the reproach of his people he will take away from all the earth, for he who is has spoken. And it will be said on that day, behold, this is our God. We've waited for him that he might save us. This is he who is. We've waited for him. Let us be glad and rejoice in his salvation. And of course, that is all about Jesus, whose name means he who is salvation. And he was the one that the Old Testament saints were waiting for, and now he's the one that we New Testament saints are waiting for. And when he comes back, death will be gone. It is the last enemy to be put down. And because there's no more death, there's not going to be crying, there's not going to be funerals, there's not going to be mourning, there's not going to be disease to be grieved by, no hospitals, nothing like that, no pain, no handicap, no amputations or anything of that nature. Because as it says here in Revelation 21:4, the former things have passed away. We have gotten back to God's original plan. And so everything that John is kind of finishing up with here is emphasizing the idea we're getting back to where sin interrupted our eternal story with God. And aren't you glad? Now, verse 5, he who was seated on the throne said, behold, I am making all things new. Also, he said, write this down, for these words are trustworthy and true. One of the reasons that God's inspired word is in written form is because that way it can be checked and referred to repeatedly over and over again by those that trust God and the ones that are waiting for him to keep his promises. And so God is basically saying, John, get these things written down because I want the people to know I guarantee it. I put my name to this contract, to this promise. He said to me, it is done. It's completed. It's reached its finishing point. I am the Alpha, which is the first letter of the Greek alphabet, and the Omega, last letter of the Greek alphabet, which is why in a lot of ancient iconography, you see Jesus represented with those two letters, the beginning and the end. And this is language taken from the Old Testament as well, that God has no beginning, he has no end, he just is. In fact, that's his name. Yahweh means he who is. And we've seen this as the one who was, is, and will always be. And here it's the Alpha, the Omega, the beginning, the end. And so Jesus also makes this promise to the thirsty, I will give from the spring of the water of life without payment. Now, as we've already seen, and we're going to see again, in the new heaven and new earth, first in the millennial kingdom, and now in the new Jerusalem, which is coming down, I think, at the end of that millennial period, there is going to be a literal source of water bubbling up on the Temple Mount, apparently either near or under the throne of Jesus. And this water goes into a river that goes both directions, east and west, One section goes down into what used to be the Dead Sea, turns it to a living sea. The other goes down into what used to be the Mediterranean area. And all along this river, there is the tree of life, the forest of life that grows up alongside of it. And so now here's the promise that is made by Jesus. Those of you that are thirsty, you now have the right to drink from this river of the water of life, and it's not going to cost you a penny. Nothing. It is free. Now, of course, metaphorically, we're already doing that, aren't we? We are drinking of Jesus. We are drinking of his Holy Spirit already. But there is going to be a literalness to it as well later. Verse number 7, the one who conquers, remember, he who overcomes, I will give, and in the book of Revelation chapters 2 and 3, there's all sorts of overcomer promises. But this one says, the one who conquers or overcomes will have this heritage. This will be his inheritance. And I will be his God, and he will be my son. So we are going to be family. And the family farm, if you want to put it that way, is the new earth. And the big house that's on the family farm is going to be this new Jerusalem we're going to read more about. Now, we have a little negativity mentioned here, but it's in a positive form. Verse 8, but as for the cowardly, now this is not talking about people that are a little bit nervous. This is talking about those who are too afraid to stand up for what is right. They know it's right, but they are afraid of what other people will do to them if they say or do things in connection with that. So Jesus said at one point, those who confess my name before men, I will confess his name before my Father in heaven. But for those who deny me, I will deny him. And so those would be the cowardly. But as for the cowardly, the faithless, you know, the ones that don't trust God, the detestable, those that engage in inappropriate behavior according to God's design standards, as for the murderers, you know, people who have no respect for the image of God and other human beings, the sexually immoral, so those that break the design standard of God that was one man, one woman together for a lifetime. The word for immorality here is a generic term for anybody that breaks that original design. Sorcerers, which is actually tied into the word pharmacy or pharmakia. So it's drug users, not people who take medicine. We're talking about those who are taking these drugs in order to tap into the spirit world. Idolaters, so those that worship other gods and goddesses, the demon spirits that are actually behind all the idols of history. And all liars, you know, those who do not uphold the truth, their portion, you know, their inheritance, because we were just talking about inheritance in verse 7. So this is the follow-up to that. Their portion, their inheritance, their family plot will be in the lake that burns with fire and sulfur, which is the second death. And I don't really want to spend lots of time talking about that because it is so sad, especially at this juncture in our study. Let us suffice it to say that God has promised eternal life to everyone that was created in his image and likeness. That was his intention from the very beginning. He made us as eternal beings. We would live forever. And so we will all live forever someplace. These guys, because of their choices, will live outside the presence of God. And that will be their free will choice. let's do our best to help them make a better choice than that ahead of time. Verse number 9, then came one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls full of the seven last plagues and spoke to me. And we've seen this happen before. One of those angels comes up and talks with John, tries to explain some things to him. So he said, come, I'll show you the bride, the wife of the Lamb. Now, the last time this happened, the angel was showing John the bad woman that was riding on the back of the beast. This time he says, let me show you the great woman, the great lady. And actually, I think this lady is that great lady of Revelation chapter 12 that we talked about before. The covenant people of God through all ages that were looking forward to having a relationship with God, a perfect relationship. And so here I think she takes on the form of a bride. Come, I will show you the bride, the wife of the Lamb. And he carried me away in the spirit to a great high mountain. Mountains very often symbolize kingdoms. And he showed me the holy city, Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven. Now that's where the chapter started, right? Having the glory of God. Now, the glory of God is often manifested in visible light. It is expressed as something bright and shiny, but there is material to it. There is weight to it. In fact, the Old Testament word for glory has the sense of heaviness, weight that comes down upon you. Now, its radiance, like a most rare jewel, like jasper, clear as crystal. Now, we're going to see a whole bunch of precious and semi-precious stones mentioned in the text here. And I'm not going to try to describe all of them. Some of them are a little bit more vague, I think, than we care to credit. But jasper, we do understand. Jasper is kind of a yellowish stone. But it is not the jasper we know now, plainly, because it is clear as crystal. It is transparent. And that's literally what the word means. It can be shined through. And so this jasper is the overall shininess that's coming off of this city. It's like golden. It had great high wall. And we'll talk about that wall tomorrow a little bit more. With 12 gates, and at the gates, 12 angels. And on the gates, the name of the 12 tribes of the son of Israel were inscribed. Now, it's interesting to me, the last part of Ezekiel that tells the story of a new city being raised up at Jerusalem, the city that they were supposed to build when they came back from exile. It describes the city as having 12 gates, and it names these gates according to the tribes of Israel. Let me read to you. It says that on the north side, the gate of Reuben, the gate of Judah, the gate of Levi. The east side is the gate of Benjamin and Joseph, Benjamin, and Dan. South side is Simeon, Issachar, Zebulun. And then the only other side, west side, is Gad, Asher, and Naphtali. And I have no reason not to believe that that is exactly the names that are on these gates that John is seeing. And so verse 13 says, this is back in Revelation 21, the east, three gates, on the north, three gates, south, three gates, and on the west, three gates. And the wall of the city had 12 foundations. Now, I believe that this means 12 levels. Now, I can't prove that, but maybe. and I will speculate on that idea later. But the thing that John wants us to hear, because he's writing this down from what the angel told him, is that on them were the 12 names of the 12 apostles of the Lamb. So one of these foundations will be the John Foundation, which he's the one that's hearing all of this. And so we have the 12 sons of Israel and the 12 apostles of the Lamb that have sections, gates, named after them in this great big giant city that comes down upon the new earth at, I believe, the end of the millennium, and it really kicks off eternity. We've got a little over a minute left, and so we'll now kind of delve in to a logistical description of the city. And I'll have a little speculation to throw at you for this. Verse 15, the one who spoke with me had a measuring rod of gold to measure the city and its gates and its walls. We saw something similar to this in the book of Ezekiel, where things get measured and the numbers get written down, and the numbers are significant. The first number we get is the size of the city. Verse 16, the city lies 4 square, its length the same as its width. So that's the first thing we learn about it, is that it is a perfect square in 2 dimensions to start with. And he measured the city with his rod 12,000 stadia. Now, 12,000 is a significant number. It is 12, which is an important number, times 1,000, which is an important number. The stadia was about 607 feet. And so this is a very large number describing how big this city. But exactly how big it is, I want to talk to you the next time we get into God's Word.